This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. You know, for most of us, our coming-of-age stories start and end during our years in high school or maybe into college, and they're defined by strong relationships, rebellion, and then that awkward junior prom. Then there is Lori Horvitz. Her coming-of-age story was decades in the making, and when she finished writing it, the product was a collection of comedic essays that covered her childhood, adolescence, and adulthood. Each of them tells a story of her search for identity as a quiet Jewish girl from Long Island who was also exploring her sexuality. Lori Horvitz is a professor of literature and the director of the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies program at UNC Asheville. Her memoir is called The Girls of Usually, and she joins me now from the studios of WCQS in Asheville. Hello, Lori.
Hello.
Tell us about this memoir. How did it start?
It started actually when I moved to Asheville. I actually got hired at UNCA to teach fiction, and during my first year, I started writing nonfiction.
There you go.
and I started writing these nonfiction essays, and one kept on following another. I didn't plan to write a book, but they just kind of, I think as writers, we write about what we're obsessed with, and those sort of underlying obsessions just pervade every piece of writing. So I just kept exploring identity and connection and love and family in pretty much all my essays. So they became a collection, and now they're the book called The Girls of Usually. They're interrelated, and it kind of has an arc. So
First essays, those first nonfiction essays you wrote, were they autobiographical, or were you writing about other topics initially?
They were pretty much all autobiographical.
And what about, you're teaching nonfiction, or fiction, you're interested in fiction. How did that, inform your writing as a memoirist?
Well, it's interesting because I started out as a poet. I have an MFA in poetry from Brooklyn College, and that's where I studied with Allen Ginsberg. And I realized that I was writing a lot of autobiographical poetry, a lot of childhood poems and poems about travel. And then I went to SUNY Albany, where I did a PhD, and one of the classes I took was a class called Feminist Narrative Strategies, and the teacher made us write fiction. So I was like, oh, okay, I'll write some fiction. And I realized that fiction I based it on personal experience, but said, well, what if this happened? And created these fictional stories, and that was really fun. It's kind of like poetry, but kind of expanding out on it. And then when I came to Asheville, I became more into, and we'll talk about this later in one of my excerpts I want to read, but just creating more of a more realistic stories. And so the fiction kind of sprouted into nonfiction.
Well, you mentioned Allen Ginsberg in passing, but I'd like to spend a little time with it. In fact, the title of the book comes from an experience you had with Allen Ginsberg. Tell us about that.
That's right. An experience I had while I was working with Allen Ginsberg. The Girls of Usually is actually from a quote from a Mexican woman who I dated in New York. And she was a non-native speaker. So when I would ask her, who's coming to the party? She's like, the Girls of Usually. Kind of a mistranslation. Mm-hmm. So that's the title of a story. And I start off by the story by talking about Allen Ginsberg and how he was asking me about my sexuality.
Will you read for us?
Sure. I'll read that section. So this is the beginning of the story, The Girls of Usually. During my first semester of grad school, I met with Allen Ginsberg every Thursday night to discuss my poetry. One night, I brought him a cryptic poem about my girlfriend, Maria. "Is this about a man or a woman?" he asked, twirling a tuft of his gray beard. "A woman," I said, almost ashamed. "So you like girls, or are you bisexual?" I wasn't sure why I felt so uneasy discussing my personal life with Allen Ginsberg. I guess bisexual. "When I was younger, I slept with a lot of women," he said. "That's the only way you find out who you really like to be with." Perhaps I felt nervous because I was talking to an American icon, or because we were in a mint green classroom, or because I felt ashamed I was with a woman, or because I wasn't sure why I was still with Maria. She and I had argued about her drinking. We argued about her close friendship with a woman who bought her compact discs, household appliances, and often wined and dined her at fancy restaurants. Maria, a native of Mexico City, had been awarded a year-long postdoc fellowship to study the brain's elasticity and its relation to memory. In a windowless lab near Washington Square Park, she performed experiments and designed computer programs. While she studied graphs about short and long-term memory retention and which hemisphere of the brain remembered what, I wrote poetry about my childhood and dead poodles and vague declarations about my ambivalent sexuality. One teacher said, "The unspoken, the white space between the lines, is just as important, or more important, than the words themselves. Sometimes I wanted to get lost in that white space."
Lori Horvitz reading from her collection of memoir essays, The Girls of Usually. So clearly you were dating a woman. You talked about sort of liking to hang in the spaces between the lines. Was there something about Allen Ginsberg's question sort of forcing you to define who that was, define yourself, that made you uncomfortable, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was still a little bit closeted and, afraid to come out fully. And I think, you know, it's interesting. A student asked me yesterday, who are your biggest influences? And I said, well, I have to say that Allen Ginsberg and the Beat Generation, Allen Ginsberg taught me, you know, you can't be vulnerable. You have to be direct. You can't hide behind metaphor. You can't hide behind abstractions. You know, the best thing is to just be direct and be raw and get it out there. So that's what I learned from them.
You must howl.
Allen Ginsberg.
The book starts with some stories from your childhood, and maybe we should get you to tell us about growing up in Long Island.
Well, Long Island. I always felt like an outcast. I was the shy kid in the back of the classroom who never said a word. I got picked on ever since, you know, first grade. And I took up magic. I actually performed at birthday parties as a magician. And this is actually one of the last essays I wrote, is the first essay in the book, because I was a magician, and there's a picture of me that I have from when I was 14. And I never wrote about it. I never wrote why I took up magic, and I never really thought about it. I just did it. So the first essay kind of is a meditation on why I took up magic.
Maybe I can ask you to read from that.
Sure. This is the magician. That's me at 14 in my one-piece tuxedo shirt, magic wand in hand, my sad eyes focused on the camera. If you look closely, you can see the tripod's reflection in the window behind me. I took the photo. I had 9 seconds to press the self-timer button and run into the frame. Back then, I could turn a penny into a dime, transform a red scarf into a green one, and pull coins from the ears of unsuspecting children. Sometimes I performed at birthday parties. "How'd you do that?" the kids asked, and I said, "It's magic," and left it at that. I also played the psychic game with my sister. One of us would pick a card and telepathically communicate to the other which card we had picked by focusing with all of our might. One time we got 10 in a row and got scared and stopped playing the game. My world of magic brought me into another dimension, far from the house I grew up in, the house built on suburban landfill, where I moved a dresser in front of my bedroom door because my mother would barge in, despite the sign taped to it, "Please knock before entering." As if she knew the precise moment I'd take my shirt off to change into something else, she would find me topless. "Let me see your breasts," she'd say. "Have they grown at all? Where's your period already? If you don't get it soon, I'm taking you to the doctor." When I did get my period at 15, she said, "Mazel tov," and gave me a lifetime supply of sanitary napkins.
Lori Horvitz reading from her collection of memoir essays, The Girls of Usually. You think about magic as the art of directing attention, and I guess
exactly.
If you direct attention away from yourself, that's a fine thing to do early on. But getting back to Ginsberg's advice, ultimately you're going to have to do two things. First of all, pay attention to yourself and acknowledge things, and then, as a writer, sort of expose those either through fiction or nonfiction. Was there a moment for you where there was, you can take on board this lesson, that must make sense, that I believe it. When did you finally sort of acknowledge that you were going to have to make the jump, you were going to have to be honest out loud as a writer?
Well, it's interesting because my path to becoming a writer started with magic. And then I went to undergraduate school at a small public liberal arts school, similar to UNCA up in New York at SUNY Purchase. And I was a fine art major, and I did photography and printmaking. And I played with photography. I did a lot of experimental work and playing with time and temperature and multiple exposures and all kinds of trick photography. And then I went traveling, and I couldn't do my photography anymore. I didn't have the access, the supplies. So I started writing. And I started writing poetry and journaling, and that's when I started writing and taking workshops and bringing in really bad poetry and abstract poetry. And then, you know, the teacher would always push me and say, you know, you got to be concrete. What really happened? And so that's when I started writing stuff that scared me. And, wow. You know,
well, and you had
being
some,
more honest.
And as and all the while, you're having some fairly exotic adventures, including your trip on the Trans-Siberian Railroad. Tell us about that.
Well, I was living in New York, and I traveled to Israel when I was 19, and I met this British guy on a kibbutz, and he was telling me about these trips that were run by an 85-year-old British communist who was based in northern England, in Huddersfield, England, and he came to visit me a few years later, and he brought this Xerox catalog of these trips, and one of the trips was a trip to all overland from London, Moscow, London, Budapest, Moscow, Peking, and back, all overland for $600. And I said, you know what? I got to do this. So I saved up money, and I sublet my New York apartment, and I took this trip. And it was this amazing trip. We met in London. We took a bus to Budapest, and that's where we got the Trans-Siberian. And there were 38 people on the trip. They're all British except me. Mostly lefties. A couple of people actually said they were communists, but most people were just sort of more liberal. And we were on the train for most of the trip. We were 10 days in Peking, 4 days in Moscow, but besides that, we were on that journey. And this was in November, so we actually went through Siberia.
On the Trans-Siberian Railroad in November with British communists. What could be better?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
that's sort of every girl from Long Island should do that at least once.
That's right.
So you did. What did you learn on that trip about yourself? Did you have also views? I think anytime you leave the country, you sort of have a different view of what it means to be an American, too.
Oh, absolutely. You know, just being in Russia and China and you know, this was during, you know, Ronald Reagan's era. So all we learned about was the horrible communists. And, you know, I'm sitting on the train in the subway in Moscow, and these people are just looking at us, and, you know, they're just like, they look like you and me, and they just want to have a life. And then we went to Peking, and everyone is just lining up to stare at us. This was in 1984. So they weren't used to seeing Westerners, and they were just so, like, we were the exotic other, and we were lining up to see Mao's dead body. Also on this trip, I mean, this is one of the biggest, the longest essays in the book. It's called, it's about this journey to Russia and China. It's called Slow Train to the Forbidden City. And that's where I first sort of learned about my love of women. I developed a huge crush on the woman who was leading the trip, who was a year older than me. I was 23. She was 24.
Will you read from that essay for us?
Sure. So the woman's name was Rita. And this is an excerpt from that. Every 4 or 5 hours, the train picked up passengers along the way. Rita and I had 15 minutes to run onto the platform and buy cookies and dumplings and cans of sardines and linen pins. All the while, I couldn't make eye contact with her without blushing, and I waited for this sentiment to pass, but it pulled up alongside me and stared me in the face. The Russian countryside turning and twisting, wrapped around rivers, mountains, and cornfields. The rhythm of the train clacked upon tracks and steeped like black Russian tea into my blood. It became my lifeline. This was my world. Warmth, motion, tea from a samovar for the equivalent of 2 cents, a growing fixation on Rita and the sun rising and falling. Heat blasted from the train's vents, but the windows were screwed shut. The official word on this, the Soviet government ordered the windows locked so foreigners couldn't escape into Russia. I got used to the heat and walked around in a tank top in the middle of the Siberian winter. A teenage boy wearing a turquoise sweatsuit stared at my $2 LCD watch and offered me 10 rubles. I followed him to his cabin and he stuffed the ruble wad in my hand. I felt a thrill off of getting away with something, of beating the system. When a big bearded Freud-looking man caught me in between train cars and in a low gravelly voice asked, "Do you have Playboy?" I sold him my sneakers.
Lori Horvitz reading from the essay Slow Train to the Forbidden City from her collection The Girls of Usually. We're talking about it today on The State of Things. You talked about this being the first romance you had with a woman. Was this a surprise to you, or had you known for a long time that this was?
Oh, it was a total surprise. I went to a public liberal arts school in New York, and I hung out with the hippie boys, and it was a pretty liberal school. The Gay and Lesbian Organization was the biggest organization on campus. It was pretty accepted there, and no, I never had an inkling until that moment when I said, "What's going on with me?" You know, this. You know, and I was sort of trying to deny it at first, and then I thought, well, you know, let's see what happens. And nothing happened on the trip. It only happened afterwards, but it was pretty torturous.
How much of it do you think the freedom to finally express who you were and feel who you were came from being in a place where nothing looked like, or so little looked like, had the same cultural cues that reminded you, you better be like this back home?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I never thought about that. But yeah, I think when you're traveling, you definitely take more risks. You don't have to be who you think people think you are. So you could explore more. I think traveling is about taking risks. And I was alone. Remember, I traveled a lot alone when I was in my early 20s. I was pretty brave then. I don't think I'm as brave now.
Well, the book ends in the nearly present day after you gave the keynote address at a graduation ceremony to a group of LGBT students. How did you bring that around to your realization? Again, this is kind of a coming-of-age collection, but it took you a long time, Laurie.
That's right. It's not just me. I think the culture and society came around, too. And for a long time, I mean, I grew up in, you know, I came of age in the 80s. And, you know, being gay and lesbian was still pretty taboo. And even though I lived in most of my 20s in New York City, I still felt like there's something wrong with me and I need to get married and find a man and have kids. And that stuck with me. I mean, that stuck with me, like, you know, even when I got to Asheville for a while. And finally, I saw students who were so open and out, my own students. I mean, I kind of learned from them. But I think just traveling really gave me that sense of freedom, as you said, and coming to terms with who I am. Also, writing helped me come to terms with who I am, to explore the blank page. There's a similarity between exploring through your writing, exploring sexuality, exploring through travel.
Well, I wonder if I can get you to read from one of your last essays in the book, Father's Advice.
Sure. The book also talks about my reluctance to claim my cultural heritage, my Jewish heritage. And I think when I came to Asheville, I kind of was an outsider here, which made me feel more connected to myself. So this is Father's Advice. During each conversation I have with my father, he insists I go to the local synagogue. He repeats himself over and over. The rabbi is very nice, he says. It'll do you good. But I'm not one for organized religion. When I moved to North Carolina for my teaching job, I left New York, but New York didn't leave me. Now I was a New Yorker in the South, more of a New Yorker than ever before. I'm a Yankee Jew in a place where most people can count their Jewish friends on one hand. I'm a novelty. After learning I'm Jewish, people here are awed. Some ask if I'm 100% Jewish. Full-blooded? I say, wow, that's so cool. Although I'm a non-practicing Jew, I have begun to embrace my heritage. I even taught a college class, Art of the Holocaust. We looked at all forms of art, some created during the Third Reich, some made later as a result of it. I told my class the enormity of the Holocaust, the reality of it, didn't hit me until I walked through Auschwitz. One student confided in me that his family is German-Jewish. Even though most of his family got out in time, he said, they never discussed the Holocaust. I'm glad I'm finally learning about it. The material we read and watched and listened to was difficult and disturbing, but by the end of the semester, most students were glad they had taken the class. And little did they know, much of the material was new to me. One student comment from a course evaluation, since our professor is Jewish, she really knows what she's talking about.
Laurie Horvitz, reading from her collection of essays, The Girls of Usually. Are you feeling a little more settled in these days?
This is my 16th year in Asheville.
Well, Laurie, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Laurie Horvitz is a professor of literature at UNC Asheville. Her memoir is called The Girls of Usually, and you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org.